Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, award-winning arts and music writer Andy Bader talks about his first biography, Cosmic Music, The Life, Art, and Transcendence of Alice Coltrane. It explores the life of a woman who was an accomplished musician and spiritual leader, and she was also the wife of acclaimed jazz saxophonist John Coltrane. Cosmic Music was published by DaCapo in March 2026, and in June of this year, Andy Bader was interviewed via Zoom by Bio member and podcast producer Carolyn Van Putten.
This is a privilege. Thank you for allowing me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me join you. I'm looking forward to it.
I think I've heard you say, and certainly I think I saw you write, that you'd not written a book before. So what would prompt you to write a book about this person in particular?
Yeah, you know, I worked for many years as a journalist and a writer in that capacity. And so I was used to working in that sort of length and when those sorts of fast deadlines. And, you know, the book actually kind of came out of this failure of sorts. I had wanted to write a book about music and spirituality. And I had, you know, laid out a full book plan and was tracing it from, like, you know, the Beatles with, you know, the Maharishi to, you know, John Cage and Zen Buddhism, you know, John and Alice Coltrane and their sort of spiritual quest and stuff like that. And then that wasn't really going anywhere. And one of the editors was like, well, how about a book on Alice Coltrane? And my response was no. And yet, you know, I had written about her quite a bit over these years. One of the things I forgot that I had written in my many years of writing is I actually wrote an obituary for her in, like, the Detroit Times when she passed in 2007. And then I was working on a piece about her great nephew, Flying Lotus. And we had actually had met a couple times over the years for different pieces. And we'd always had, like, talked about her and, you know, like his, how important she was for him. And he would tell me these, like, just like fascinating stories about her. And one of the trips when I was there, you know, I learned that the ashram was, like, still in existence. And this wasn't going to be part of the piece, but I was like, I really feel like I need to go and experience this. I've always been, like, fascinated by this idea that she had her own ashram. And so I just drove out there, you know, by myself and spent, like, an afternoon there and met some of the ashram members and stuff like that, and kind of continued to have a correspondence with them over the years. And sort of in 2017, I worked on this project that was, like, reissuing her ashram tapes and, you know, did more interviews with people from the ashram and stuff like that. And I always just, in doing these pieces on her, just felt like there just wasn't a resource that really told her full story. There was, you know, kind of a dissertation turned monograph by, like, the late Franja Berkman, you know, which was about as thorough a book as there was out there. And that was, you know, a pretty slim volume. And then there had been these, like, self-published books by ashram members that really focused on their years at the ashram with her and, like, the work that she had done there. And I was really just waiting for a book that would kind of try to really capture the full arc of her story from her childhood in Detroit through her years with John and then her own solo work. And there was just really not much out there. I don't think I came across, like, a major jazz magazine feature of her from the, you know, the 60s and 70s. There was just really nothing like that. And a lot of the times interviews with her would be about John's music. There was almost no discussion where she's explaining, like, her own music at that time. Yeah. And so, you know, I said no. And And then I started kind of just really thinking about it and like wondering what it would be like. In part because I didn't know if the family would be part of it, if there was a reason there wasn't a book on her in the past. And, you know, my challenge was, can you tell this story only working with what's in the archives, what can be found like in a public sort of thing? And that was kind of the challenge of the book. So.
You started from a place of wanting to write a book about music and spirituality. Do I recall correctly that you indicated never having written a book before at all?
Yes, I had never written a book, and quite honestly, the writer mindset is often like, you're not going to be able to do this. You're going to blow the deadline. It's going to be a mess. And I think even in the writing of the book, as I told you that challenge, I think there was a part of me that was like, you're going to hit a wall at some point, and you're going to get to some part that you can't get around, and it's never going to happen. And was slightly surprised myself to have, gotten to the end. Even though I guess inevitably I knew I would sort of be able to get there, there was still like a little bit of disbelief in crossing the finish line, so to speak.
Before you get to the end, though, you have to start. So, what drives you to start something that you perhaps don't think you're going to be able to do at all to begin with, and then certainly about someone that you were initially less inclined to say, this is my inspiration?
There was a lot of like doubt as a writer, but then also just sort of, I had been in touch with the family estate or whatever, but I wasn't certain that they were gonna be of assistance or say, don't go there or what have you. I mean, one of the reasons music and spirituality like speaks to me is, I had like my own like kind of meditation practice or whatever. And I remember I collated all the notes, I had done all the research, and, there really just isn't a lot of research as well. Like, when I was doing stuff and going to like the performing arts libraries or the Schomburg Center or the Rutgers University Jazz Studies, I would be through all the material in the collection like within a few hours. I think at Rutgers before the parking meter was up, even. So I had this doubt and, just how was I going to do this? And, how am I going to tell the story of this spiritual person or whatever? And I just remember sitting in like meditation, thinking about it, this tumult of thoughts, and this thing was presented to me that was like, dedicate the book to God, which is what she did, with her music and her works. And if you do this for God, it's going to happen. So when you read the book at the first page, it's to God. And that was my, way of always kind of think of it in those terms. And I came across one of her quotes early on where she says, everything I do is an offering to God, and let the chips fall where they may kind of mentality about it. So if I knew if I was in my heart really going to stay true and present the story in like the most sort of reverent way and sort of exemplify her art in that manner, then I felt like I could accomplish it.
So, having the experience that you've just had of doing that thing that you didn't think you were able to do, what counsel or what advice would you give to someone who's never written a book, let alone a biography?
I think one of the best pieces of advice I received along the way was from someone who had written a book, and they were like, do all the research you can, do all the interviews you can, and line it all up, because once you start writing, you're going to want to just write without stopping. And that's really the best path forward, that daily momentum of it. There really is like a rush to it as the book starts going, and you can really, you're laying down the tracks and the train's rolling down it, so to speak. And it was really important to kind of have that momentum and just every day know that this was going to be the next step. I mean, there'd be times I'd just wake up in the night, just almost like too excited, knowing what was going to be the work for the next day. And yeah, so it was just really, it was like, make sure that when you're ready to write, that you have as like clear a path as possible, because there will be things that kind of disrupt you just in, your daily responsibilities or what have you. But it was really important to just have that wealth of research to kind of draw on and know that if you can't remember something, you know that you have done all the due diligence in getting that information and you can just kind of plug it in and just kind of keep going forward with it. And if you come to like a complete stop, to overcome that inertia and keep going. And on one hand, I wish I had written a book earlier, but on the same hand, I also realize that the book I wrote now as a 50-year-old with a family and my community here would have been far different. I'd loved Alice's music for many years. If I had tried writing it when I was 30, I don't know how much ego and whatever would have been in it instead, in a way. And I think there was an understanding I learned, much older, that allowed me to sort of present this work in this sort of way.
You've spoken about the research process and seeking and finding some archival information. Where did you wind up going once you had an idea of where to start?
Obviously, since I'd first written about her in like 2007, and there were probably a dozen articles I'd written since then, I sort of knew like the general trajectory. Obviously, you just go into the library and looking through things. And it kind of really presented to me this aspect of how she was perceived in the jazz world, and not often in a positive light, so to speak. And it was a lot of like trying to figure out who to speak with. This one musician I knew in California, I think he had met her like at some point in the 90s, and he makes music now. And I remember speaking with him kind of really early on in the process, because again, there I didn't have a lot of biographical information to kind of go on. The book that Alice Soleimani herself wrote, Monument Eternal, is probably about 80 pages, and it's very much about the spiritual vision she had at this time. You're not going to really go there and learn about her marriage to John Coltrane or what it was like in the studio or anything like this. This is very much a spiritual sort of work that she produced. So I think my original vision was, if I can't tell the full like arc of her story, is part of the book just about, her influence now? Is it about this new generation and how they perceive her? And this musician was like, I'm very glad you're doing this work. I think that if you're going to do this in a way that's successful, you need to only speak with the people that knew her, people that played with her, people that lived at the ashram, people that she did the recordings with, and that it was very important to kind of get these firsthand stories of Alice Coltrane, Swamini Turiya Sangeetananda. And I mean, that was a pretty tall order, because just about every major musician she had performed with had passed away. I mean, Roy Haynes had just passed, Charlie Hayden had passed, Pharoah Sanders. So in a way, it really became almost a race against time to try and reach some of, these jazz elders. And there's a lot of interviews in the book with people who have like since passed away. I'm thinking like Jack DeJohnette, George Bohannon, who was in like one of the earliest groups with her. Trying to find people from the 1950s in Detroit that played with her then was also a real tall order. Archie Shepp was another person who I reached out to, and I mean, he's still with us, but he had a lot of health issues, and I probably spent about a year and a half crossing my fingers and patiently hoping that, he would be willing to chat when he felt more like himself. So yeah, at a certain point, I think I kind of started conceiving of the book as almost like a clear box for these stories. And as you see kind of in the text, there's a lot of times where I just have block quotes from people talking about her, and as much as I could, trying to preserve these voices and these stories like intact, and not just, oh, pulling out a line, here's my take and here's my analysis, but just really like, this is a story they're telling, and I'm going to keep it intact. And I'm going to just let these voices sort of speak for her. Or, on the rare occasions I had of, her interviews or whatever, just very much letting her voice come through and not disrupting it, not interrupting it, not analyzing it. There are some incredible spiritual visions she talks about, and it was important for me to like let those kind of be set in place and not doubt them or be skeptical about the vision she had, or these ex spiritual experiences she had, but to just really let her present it.
It's, I'm sure, particularly challenging to write about someone whose artistic output is not in words. So writing about a musician and that musician's music, using words to describe experiences that are not what music consists of. And in her case, in Alice Coltrane's case, more so perhaps even than other musicians because of her name recognition, part of it anyway. And yet, it's not about her name recognition, it's about her music. So what would you say were some of the challenges you faced in dealing with a life centered on what is essentially ephemeral and necessarily subjective?
You know, the book really is sort of framed by these two fires that occurred soon after her passing. And there's one fire, the Woolsey fire, which burned the ashram and every structure on it to ashes. And also at the end, the Universal fire, which burned tens of thousands of recorded documents, including all of the recordings of her late husband, John Coltrane, and her own work, along with countless others. And you talk about the ephemeral aspect of it, and it really does kind of bring into clarity that's just life itself. Here are these great works of this person, and they are turned into ash, like literally. And there was another part, you know, in kind of understanding her biography, where the kind of losses she suffered at this one point in the 1960s, where in less than like a 3-year period, both of her parents passed, John passed, her half brother, Ernest Farrow, passed away. And just that level of grief you would have to bear, you know, just as a person, and that harsh lesson of, yeah, this is all temporal. If you want to have a good understanding of, you know, the briefness of life, lose your parents, your husband, and your brother would be a really powerful lesson in that way. In terms of the music, I don't really think of myself as a jazz writer per se. There's not really musical analysis in a lot of the book. I mean, there were kind of two aspects as I was working on the book that kind of came to mind, and two things that I really wanted to argue for. One was this perception in the jazz world that she was just this woman that had no talent and she married the right man. And that's why, you know, she got to record her music. And the other was that she's not really this like spiritual leader. She was just off in La La Land or what have you. And those are like the two, I think, main pillars of criticism and negativity towards her. And as I did this research, I was, you know, like, she was a great bebop jazz pianist. And maybe that's not what her legacy is resting on, but I don't think you can really fake your way through jazz bebop piano. If I get up on the bandstand and they're playing, you know, Cherokee or Woody and You, you're not really going to be able to fake it till you make it in that regard. And when you look at her recorded legacy, you also see she only worked with like the greatest jazz players of that era. You know, I don't think Roy Haynes or Jack DeJohnette are humoring her by, you know, recording with her or what have you. I mean, she is a serious, serious player. And I don't think you can play with John Coltrane if you don't know what you're doing either. So I didn't really want to necessarily frame it as a jazz biography in a certain way. And in part because the jazz establishment kind of disparaged her in that way. But I think at a certain point, the music that she's making transforms and goes into this sort of uncharted territory. And especially as it goes along and she starts performing the bhajans and these like kind of devotional songs of Hinduism, in a way they kind of become like simpler in form. They're very much just antiphonal call and response. I mean, they're very much like church hymns in a way, you know. And I think at a certain point, especially as she kind of stops being like a public-facing recording artist and focuses on being a swamini and a guru for her community, there's a certain point, I think, in the book where I was like, I don't even know if this is a music biography anymore. I feel, in a way, like some of the most important aspects of who she was kind of come after she's been a recording artist. And at a certain point, I was like, I feel like I'm really telling the story of a saint, or this like profound spiritual being and this spiritual message that she was kind of conveying, whether it was in her music or just her example as like a person and as a leader in her community in that regard.
Given that, who's the reader? Who are you envisioning? Who's reading the book that you felt compelled to write?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously people who really like her music, people especially, of a younger generation. I think they tune into Alice's music far more than they tune into John's music. I think you listen to John's music and it's very much of the jazz tradition and you can, trace that kind of history. I think her music is almost like a rupture in like the jazz history in a way. And I kind of chatted with a lot of like jazz writers who during that era never paid attention to her music. They love John's music. They listen to her music and it didn't seem to have like the structure that underpins jazz for the most part. I think if you are, you're into Oscar Peterson and like jazz piano trios or whatever, you don't listen to a monastic trio and hear the piano trio continuum. It's very much like a break in that sort of regard. And so I think for like a younger generation, especially as she moves into more kind of abstract things or uses the like, electric keyboards or does the recordings herself, whatever those aspects are, it made sense that in a way that when like the Renaissance and this reappreciation ever started happening, it was coming kind of from these other fields. There were a lot of like electronic musicians that liked her music, people who were into like ambient and new age music that gravitated towards her, rock and experimental bands kind of understood where she was coming from a little bit more. I remember speaking with Brandy Younger about it because she came to Alice's music not through jazz, but through classical music. And, I remember her being like, I'm so relieved that there's this black female harpist who's making her own music. That's who I want to be like. I don't want to play in like the pit orchestra, kind of that regard. And so I think those are little easier inroads to Alice's music than I think if you're coming from like the jazz history and the jazz tradition, because she's very much disruptive in that regard. And so I think that's maybe a little bit why like a younger generation appreciates her. And there's a lot of people who are looking for meaning and like a spiritual understanding of this world. And I think there's something that's in her music that speaks to people who are seeking in that regard. I think one of the like most edifying stories in the book is one of her first devotees, which is Purushottama Hickson, who's I think bussing a table in San Francisco in like 1973, and Universal Consciousness is playing. I think he sets like this tray of dirty dishes on the ground and like goes and lays down in front of the stereo because he's so like overcome by this message that's in her music that he's able to kind of pick up on. I think it's maybe even the first line of the book where he's like, I looked at this picture of her and I knew that she knew these spiritual questions I had. I knew that she had been to the mountaintop and she had these answers. And again, like I don't think of it in terms of like a jazz biography in that regard. I really do think of it for, people in spirituality and wellness. There's parts of the book that speak to them, but there's also kind of a historical aspect to the book kind of in the beginning. So kind of understanding Detroit, between the wars and the sort of racial strife of that and that sort of history, and knowing that those sorts of conflicts that she comes out of, I think it kind of can speak to that aspect as well. I think one of the more remarkable things when I was researching the book is to come across her at a young age being one block away from what at the time and for more than half a century was the worst racial violence in the United States, the Belle Isle riots of Detroit, that you would grow up as a child and that would be, probably one of your formative memories. And then at the same time, the riots that surpassed the Belle Isle riots in terms of the worst and sort of damage and loss of life would be the LA riots in, the early 90s. And to sort of realize that she's there as well. And, as this cycle kind of comes back around, here she is as this profound source of good. doing good deeds and like really trying to help those communities rebuild in the wakes of the riots. And also just beyond spirituality as being detached from everything. And I think that's one of the, stumbling blocks is people think of the spirituality as, detachment and not being concerned with these earthly things. And she had that, but she was also, with it in that regard and did actual concrete things to help others and not just thoughts and prayers, so to speak.
Although so much of her time was spent in thoughtful prayer.
She had that too, but she could pair it to real things.
So what age are these younger generation people that you're talking about? I'm trying to situate myself in today's reality. So what age are these people?
College kids, 20 somethings, There's a lot of those folks when I do readings out here in New York. That's like younger generation who's kind of like becoming more aware of her and like her work.
So, how did you use her musical recordings to situate yourself in the story of her life?
As much as I could, I would sort of orient my listening kind of along those lines, listening to kind of the music of Detroit of the 1950s, sort of when she was coming up. Because it's hard to, sort of place her in that moment in time. There's not really a lot about her. There's one 45 she made with like her first group called the Premiers, which I was a kind of a fascinating little time capsule in a way because it sort of anticipates what's going to become the sound that literally her next door neighbor Berry Gordy would crystallize as like the Motown sound, right? It's just kind of sophisticated black pop, but like has vocals, but it has really kind of complex chords kind of going on, but it has these like really nice layered vocals and harmonies. And if she had done it like 5 years later, she probably would have been like playing for a Motown group in that regard. So just kind of using that. And then obviously, when I get to like the John Coltrane years, I got to spend a lot of time with like John Coltrane's records. And just, really as much as I could, like trying to listen to it chronologically and, get an understanding that way. And there's a lot of great books on John Coltrane, and Alice is almost always neglected in this regard, or just really like a footnote. And you can read a lot about John's first wife, but not about the woman who bore him 3 sons that she played music with. So it was really kind of fascinating to tell John Coltrane's story through her now, where he's the secondary character. And it was really also just fascinating to find the exact moment when they meet and how John's music starts to like change immediately. He's emboldened to kind of undertake these experiments and these like grander visions that he had been kind of dissuaded from going down that path. And then when they connect, you can just almost immediately hear his music start to like take these giant steps forward, so to speak. And yeah, it was a really fascinating lens to kind of have a better understanding of what was going on in his music. And obviously, the third part of the book is just very much about her music, album by album, and like how the biography of her and these changes that she was undergoing, especially spiritually, began to like manifest in the music and how that music started changing as well. And I also find one of the things about her music is that there's always something new in it. I think when I play Universal Consciousness, it's the 1,000th time, but it also has this feeling of it being like the first time. There's something in it that's very revitalizing in a way. It just really doesn't age in a way or become overly familiar. I think there's always something new kind of going on in it that you can kind of understand and pick out. And there are definitely albums of hers that, maybe the 100th time listening to, I would be like, wow, I feel like I've never heard this before. And there's always something remarkable to kind of glean from it.
There's the research process, there's the writing process, and then there's the publishing process. So, how did that go for you?
It went pretty well, I would say. Neither my agent nor my editor thought I was going to hit the deadline, where I was like, I have to hit the deadline, and was full bore ahead, making sure that I, got to the finish line and turned it in on time. That was important for me, just in terms of the process itself. The other thing I think that was funny was I overwrote the book by about 40,000 words. And the thing was, is they didn't cut any of it. I think I remember going through it and being like, I don't think there's a lot I can take out of here. Like, I feel like everything has to be here. And I felt really kind of fortunate that my editor and my agent ultimately felt the same way as well. I just really hope there's more scholarship to come. I'm not really a religious studies person. So I think if someone who can kind of delve more into like her esoteric spiritual teachings can sort of build off of that, or, you know, if there are more scholarly jazz music theory people who can, you know, do more analysis of her music. I want this to kind of be a foundation for everyone to sort of like build off of.
Thank you very much, Andy, for your time and your commitment to revealing
Thank
the
you.
life story of someone who most people may never have known anything about.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thanks so much for, you know, chatting with me and like reading and having such thoughtful kind of questions about it. I really appreciate that.
That was arts writer and author Andy Bader speaking with Carolyn Van Putten about his book, Cosmic Music, The Life, Art, and Transcendence of Alice Coltrane. It was published by DaCapo in March 2026, and this interview was recorded via Zoom in May of this year. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillinganes created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer, Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer, and Shireen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.